This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 39 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me is Mike Morrison. Today, we'll be talking about some of the philosophical issues in the original series episode, Return to Tomorrow. Mike, it's good of you to join us in person in your embodied form instead of your receptacle.
Well, yeah, I find that I podcast better when I'm in bodily form. However, when I got to my podcast studio, Zachary, there was this receptacle sitting on my desk, and I picked it up, and this voice said to me that he wanted to trade places with you for this podcast. And I said, that's an unacceptable risk. He said, but risk is your business. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my question is, did you bring your 600,000 years of wisdom with you to the podcast tonight?
And then some.
Well, good. You know, you can talk circles around me tonight.
This is going to be fun. Zachary, you were recently on The Ready Room, episode 201, entitled Escape from Lightball, and had a rather interesting conversation with the group there in the Ready Room about this particular episode. And I noted a few times when I went back and listened to it that it was brought up that we should discuss this or that or the other thing on Metatrex. So I'm glad we have this opportunity to sit down and talk about it. It's always great to talk about the original series and Return to Tomorrow. This is one of those episodes that, as we said in the Turbo Lift, has a little bit of everything for the Star Trek fan.
It's always fun, from my point of view, to circle back and pick up a discussion where it left off. Like you said, I talked about this episode with Chris Jones and the rest of the gang on The Ready Room, episode 201, which was called Escape from Lightball, if you want to go find that and listen to us talk about this episode on The Ready Room. But, you know, in that episode, we really kind of remarked that this episode of Star Trek is not the most coherent episode. Some of the plot elements don't add up. You get some either terrible or amazing overacting from William Shatner. Some of the plot elements just don't add up. It's not the best episode of Star Trek by a long shot. On the other hand, it has a little bit of everything you'd expect from Star Trek. You have some overacting from William Shatner. You've got some disembodied false god type aliens. You've got some sort of moral dilemma. You've got commentary on future evolution of our species, what we'll be like as we continue to evolve. It's a very rich episode, even though the episode as a whole doesn't really work for me. But it's fun to circle back and be able to talk about some of the philosophical issues in the episode that we didn't get a chance to dwell on in that episode of The Ready Room.
And you get Dr. Pulaski in her younger days when she went by the last name Mulhall.
Yeah, for some reason, I just can't pronounce that name. I want to say like Mulholland Drive or something, but it's... for some reason, I can never remember. I just call her Pulaski. Everyone does.
I'm just trying to figure out if this was before or after she hooked up with Riker's dad.
I would say before. Yeah, I don't know why, but...
just a total guess there, I'm sure.
I think it's before. I think the connection with Riker's dad is definitely a later in life kind of connection. But
I would be inclined to agree. I would be inclined.
It's only when you get a little bit older that your inhibitions are gone anyway, right? So,
well, I would say that what occurred in this particular episode of the original series had a lot to do with releasing some of her inhibitions.
you're saying this episode laid the foundation for Pulaski and Riker's dad?
I think this was essential for what occurred between Pulaski and Riker's dad.
Okay, I'm going to have to rewrite my headcanon a little bit.
I just want to say to our listeners, I don't want to get any mail saying, hey Mike, this really wasn't Pulaski. We all know this wasn't really Pulaski, but it's fun to play with. And I have to say that she gave a really good performance, and really the performances of this episode, off the subject of what we normally talk about on Metatrek, Zachary, I will say, many of the performances in Return to Tomorrow are just outstanding. Diana Muldaur, Leonard Nimoy gives a fantastic performance. It's always great to get Spock out of the box a little bit. And I thought he was just brilliant in this episode. As you mentioned, some overacting by William Shatner, but I have to say that William Shatner gives one of the most impassioned speeches you will ever see Captain Kirk give, whether it be here in the original series or in the movie era. It's just this brilliant, impassioned speech that I thought in any other episode would have just been incredible. The only reason it doesn't work in this episode is it just has nothing really to do with the dilemma that they're in. I mean, they've got kind of a conundrum here, and he gives this impassioned speech that in any other episode would have been incredible. It just didn't work in this episode.
Yeah, and before we start talking about the philosophical issues, I think I agree. One of the things I like most about the episode is actually not so much the overacting, but I like the physical acting in this episode. You know, William Shatner gives this impassioned speech, and how do you know he's impassioned? Because he's got movement, mm-hmm. you know, in a William Shatner kind of way. How do you know Leonard Nimoy is playing the character Henoch instead of playing Spock? Because he has a different sort of physical posture. And a lot of the actors in this episode get a chance to act physically and not just use their words. I think it's a really fascinating experiment in old school stage acting.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. And for that matter, I think the writing in this episode in spots was really brilliant. But again, it just... it almost seems like they took about three different Star Trek stories and threw them against the wall and, okay, this stuck, that stuck, let's put it all together and mm-hmm. we got a Star Trek story. I think you had seeds for probably three really good stories here that just woven together didn't exactly work.
Yeah, I think most people I talk to about this episode kind of agree that this is not their favorite episode of Star Trek. Even though there are some good, very robust Star Trek elements there, there's some things about philosophy we're going to talk about here in a minute. The pieces just don't add up, and it's not the most coherent episode of Star Trek you'll ever see. So it tends to be one that I skip over a bit when I do my original series rewatch. But I'm glad to be talking about it, because I one thing I love that we do on Metatrex, I love that we find these little threads in the episodes that no one's talking about, threads that people have glossed over or not taken the time to dwell upon. We try to draw out those threads here on Metatrex and make some interesting philosophical discussion out of them. So I'm glad we are sticking to an episode that is not necessarily a fan favorite.
Yeah, I totally agree, Zachary. In fact, this episode really has some deep, deep threads that I think are really fascinating. And in the Ready Room 201, you guys really got into some of that, but it just really wasn't the right setting to really dig into these in any real deep, rich sense. And I know Christopher oftentimes would say, hey, this would be great for you guys to talk about on Metatrex. And so we wanted to kind of just carry on the conversation over here on Metatrex and get into some of these and talk about some of them a little bit more. I know... for a few of these subjects we've touched on occasion in other Metatrex episodes, as we always do. We want to encourage our listeners to go back and sort of listen to our catalog. We've got 38 other episodes in the catalog up to this point, and we deal with all kinds of really interesting, fascinating philosophical content. And certainly we talk about the nature of consciousness, which this episode, Return to Tomorrow, deals with to some degree. We talk a little bit about the afterlife in previous episodes, which this Return to Tomorrow addresses to some degree. But something that this episode addresses that, quite frankly, I don't think, Zachary, we've ever talked about on mic here on Metatrex. And it has to do with a question that Philip Gilfus raised in the Ready Room. And the question is it cheating when you're not in your own body?
See, I don't feel like I can give a safe answer to that question that won't get me in trouble with someone. So I'm going to have to, pass the buck on that one.
Yeah, we might have to wave a hand to it. Philip, we would love to be able to answer that question for you, but there's not a safe answer there. So I think that's a matter of personal choice. And I think you just need to answer that question for yourself, my friend.
Yep. Sorry, Philip, you're on your own, buddy. Well, Mike, before we dive in to talk about the philosophy in Return to Tomorrow, do you want to give us a quick synopsis of the episode?
Sure, Zachary. As you may recall, Captain Kirk and the crew of the Enterprise are guided to a planet where a disembodied voice requests assistance. Sargon and his two companions are all that's left of an ancient race, and they need to borrow three bodies to build android bodies for which to exist in. But one of the disembodied aliens has another plan.
Wait, so we've got something borrowed, and we've got something blue. Spock is wearing blue. Henok is wearing blue.
Henok is wearing
blue. This sounds like the making of a disembodied marriage to me. I don't know what you're thinking, but, something borrowed, something blue.
Yeah, something borrowed, something blue, something old, something new. Well, it doesn't get any older than 600,000 years old.
And there's a new android body in the making.
We have a new android body in the making.
I think we're uncovering some hidden meaning here.
I think this is a marriage made in Trek Heaven.
Where do we go from there? That was so ridiculous.
But enough about intergalactic nuptials, Zachary. Do you think we probably should dive into some actual philosophy?
Why not? And that's the thing about this episode. It is a really ridiculous episode. There's a lot of overacting. It's easy to make jokes about the episode. But it's a surprisingly rich philosophical episode of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mike, I'm interested to kind of compare notes with you and see which philosophical themes spoke to you the most in this episode and which ones, spoke to me the most in this episode. I'm curious whether we kind of match up or whether we have different interests in terms of this episode. What's the first thing that kind of jumps out at you in your rewatch of this episode?
Well, obviously, Zachary, the first thing that jumps out at me is the disembodied voice. It's not the first time that we've encountered a disembodied voice in Star Trek, and I'll say it again, for all of the ridiculousness of this episode, it's still Star Trek, the original series. I love it. There are some really great, deep philosophical themes in this episode. All of the things that I love about the original series, I find in this episode. And so we have, first the disembodied voice of Sargon. And what this does for me, this raises some really interesting questions about the nature of consciousness. We've talked about the nature of consciousness in previous editions of Metatrex. In fact, the last time I recall that we talked about the nature of consciousness was in Metatrex 13. It was also a discussion on the original series, Spock's pineal gland. We talked a great deal about Spock's brain.
His brain is gone.
Another somewhat unpopular episode of the original series, but one that it's honestly a favorite of mine. So if you want to go back, listeners, and review Spock's Pineal Gland, episode 13, where Zachary and I talk about the nature of consciousness, we really dive into this in depth. That's one of the main things. Of course, the idea of oblivion and the afterlife, they talk a little bit about oblivion, and I find that to be an interesting concept that comes up a couple of times throughout Star Trek. I think oblivion is kind of a tough term, that especially for those of us who are theological buffs, that term connotates some very negative ideas. And so I think that raises some interesting questions. They're awfully interested and excited about the idea of going off into oblivion at the end of this. And I don't know, there's a part of me that just doesn't really set well with. I think it, again, brings up some really interesting questions that I think deserve some discussion. But we've had conversations about the afterlife in previous episodes of Metatrex.
I think it's unquestionable that consciousness is one of the themes of the episode. I mean, clearly we have disembodied consciousness. We've got the voice from nowhere. We've got the disembodied intelligences living inside these receptacles for hundreds of thousands of years. So this is a clear-cut case of mind-body dualism in Star Trek.
Yes.
You know, of course, mind-body dualism being the view that mind and body or mind and any sort of physical matter are separate substances or separate things that aren't dependent on each other. So it's unquestionable to me that dualism is a theme of the episode. I guess my problem with that as being the main theme of the episode is that it's really not analyzed in any substantive way. It's not explained. It's not questioned. It's not examined. It's not studied. It's just a given part of this episode. So for me, sort of philosophically, there's nothing to kind of hang on to and find it really interesting. I guess the thing I find interesting about it is why Star Trek is so committed to this mind-body dualism in these various places. In most of Star Trek, I would say if I had to characterize Star Trek relationship to consciousness, it's that consciousness is something to be scientifically studied. It's something, you know, Star Trek in general is scientifically progressive. It's generally skeptical of religion. So in that general take on consciousness and the nature of reality, why do we get so many of these different kinds of disembodied consciousnesses and what are essentially here false gods inside of Star Trek? Is it a religious commentary? Is this another form of Gene Roddenberry's skepticism of religion? Is he saying something interesting about the nature of consciousness that we're trying to tease out here? But why is this a persistent theme in Star Trek as a whole? Again, I don't think we get enough material to really analyze, you know, the nature of consciousness from material in the episode. My question is, why is Star Trek so obsessed with this kind of character, this kind of nature of reality, when it's otherwise so skeptical of religion and so skeptical of anything non-physical and non-scientifically explainable?
You know, Zachary, I have a theory about this, and I really don't have a whole lot to hang my theory on, except that I've done some research on Gene Roddenberry, and I know that the philosophies of the individual writers are kind of woven into the fabric of Star Trek. But I go back to Gene Roddenberry to some degree because it does seem like that there's a lot of conflict in philosophies, whereas Star Trek seems to be committed to the idea of science and atheism. And it seems to me that the general idea as far as consciousness goes would be more of an emerging consciousness from something physical instead of a metaphysical mind-body dualism. You would probably more attribute to a theological point of view. And I think that's one of the things that makes Star Trek such an interesting exploration of the human condition, because we as human beings are very conflicted in our ideas and our philosophies. But Gene Roddenberry in particular, who was raised, as I've read, Southern Baptist, and that was his upbringing. And it wasn't really until adulthood that he got away from that and he committed himself to the ideas of atheism. And so we see that a lot of his own philosophy, as he wove it into the fabric of Star Trek, was really committed to the idea of science and exploration and atheism. And so we see a departure of his own personal philosophy away from religion. But religion, theology, was still very much a part of his upbringing, and it shaped a lot of his philosophy. So I think just as Gene Roddenberry in many ways was conflicted and exploring his own ideas and philosophies and trying to make sense of it all, I think Star Trek does very much the same thing.
And I think it was pretty clear that Gene Roddenberry became committed to this idea that humankind is in its infancy, that we have a long way to go socially, we have a long way to go politically, we have a long way to go morally, and there's this sort of future evolution of humankind. And that can go one of two different directions. It can go in a very progressive Star Trek-y kind of direction, or it can be a regressive kind of development where we turn into some worse version of ourselves. And I think Star Trek has this almost schizophrenia as it relates to what the future evolution of humankind will be. On the one hand, I think Gene Roddenberry at a certain point became an optimist, like, wow, we're really going to develop into something once we shed this backwards idea of religion, once we learn to get along well with each other, once mm-hmm. we become more tolerant. Look at what humankind could become. Look at the amazing world we could create if that's the direction we go. On the other hand, by showing the disembodied aliens in this episode of Star Trek as kind of corrupt and as having progressed so much to the point where they've lost some important humanity, for a lack of a better word, they've lost that moral center that could steer mankind in a different, more positive direction. You can get something like this moral decay, and I think, you know, Gene Roddenberry here in this episode is kind of showing another possible future for humankind in our evolution. We can evolve to be more tolerant, kinder, more socially aware, you know, all the things we usually think of as Gene Roddenberry's vision of the future. Or we could continue to evolve to the point where we become arrogant and, you know, take prideful and take ourselves too seriously mm-hmm. and become the center of our own universe, right? Because we've achieved so much and because we're that special of a creature. And I think the contrast between Gene Roddenberry's vision of what future human evolution should be and what it could be in its worst incarnation, I think the aliens in this episode, the disembodied aliens, really kind of provide the contrast between Gene Roddenberry's vision and what to avoid as we continue to evolve in the future. And I think this is something we just forget about, that, we kind of think of evolution as happening in the past, you know, that we've evolved to this point. And it's very easy because we have an evolutionary history to think of ourselves as the pinnacle of evolution. There's a danger in thinking of ourselves as the pinnacle of evolution because we've achieved so much, because we have progressed, we seem more intelligent than all the other creatures around us. And so there's a danger of viewing the world from our own perspective and viewing us as the center of reality. And it's easy to just forget that, you know, if we have an evolutionary history, there's an evolutionary future. There's what we will evolve into in 1,000 years or 10,000 mm-hmm. years or 50,000 years or 1,000,000 years. And it's when you sort of take that evolutionary process and run it forward rather than backwards, you can start to ask the question, well, what could that be? What are the possible futures for our own species? You know, do we evolve into Gene Roddenberry's vision of what mankind could be in a positive sense? Do we devolve morally and socially to the point where we become arrogant, disembodied, aliens like we see in this episode? And I think the contrast between possible futures speaks to what I think of as the real purpose of this episode. I don't think of this episode as interesting because of its exploration of consciousness. I think of this episode as interesting because it portrays one possible future of evolution for us that we want to avoid. And I think, you know, this is what I love about certain kinds of dystopian fiction, just showing an anti-model, you know, something you don't want to have happen. You know, that can sort of orient your mm-hmm. your moral thinking. You can say, no, that we definitely don't want a world like this. So I think of this as in line with something like what you see in like the book 1984. Like, it's a depiction of a world that we don't want to be. These creatures here, these disembodied, arrogant creatures that have lost their humanity, again, for lack of a better word, that's something Gene Roddenberry doesn't want us to evolve into. And he's using it for contrast. Like, this is not what the future of humankind should be. We should not turn into those arrogant, disembodied aliens because we're so smart and we are so impressed with our own abilities. And Kirk's dialogue with Sargon really highlights the contrast between the arrogance that led to the situation those aliens are in and Kirk, who desperately and at all times will want to hang on to his humanity. And I think Kirk makes a really good case for that in this episode.
Kirk does make a good case, but I almost laugh when I go back and I watch this because Kirk is so condescending towards Sargon. I mean, he's having a conversation with a disembodied alien that has been disembodied for, you know, nearly 500,000 years, and Kirk is lecturing him about how superior humanity is to his race because, you know, we didn't participate in a mutual annihilation. And we don't know a whole lot about this society prior to when we come to know them in these disembodied forms that are contained in these receptacles. But we do know that Sargon and Henoch were the leaders of two factions that sought the annihilation of the other. And the result was, you know, a total annihilation of the species. And so all we have are the disembodied consciousnesses of three individuals left over from that race, but they've had 600,000 years to contemplate. And so in their android bodies, they're just going to kind of go around the galaxy and, you know, they're going to be the Tony Robbins of the 23rd century. And they're going to float around space and they're going to give motivational speeches and have conferences, and they're going to tell other species how to avoid this.
I feel like they're going to paint some Bob Ross paintings or something. You know, I can picture Sargon and maybe not Henoch, but at least Sargon and Thalesa, you know, going around giving Bob Ross painting technique lessons.
Now, see, I more imagine kind of a Tony Robbins sort of motivational thing.
Okay,
where,
sure.
Yeah, you know, they'll get a stadium, they'll fill it up, and they'll give an impassioned speech. probably steal Kirk's speech from this episode, and they'll just get up and deliver a couple speeches and, you know, a Geordi PowerPoint. They recruited Geordi from the future to do a PowerPoint for them, and so they'll get up, they'll do this, they'll charge admission, they'll sell some tchotchkes at the end, and, you know, everybody's happy.
See, I was thinking rather than like Bob Ross, happy little trees, you'd have like happy little receptacles and happy little disembodied aliens.
You can put that receptacle anywhere you want to put it. It's your receptacle.
Happy little light balls.
There's no right or wrong here. It's your receptacle.
There's only happy accidents. But seriously, Mike, you mentioned Kirk's arrogance in his response to Sargon, and I think that actually really works to help make Gene Roddenberry's point about the future evolution of humanity. I think if I guess there's what I'm trying to say is that there's always this specter of arrogance to humankind. No matter what we achieve, we can always look at ourselves and go, look how smart we are. And when Sargon basically says, look, you know, we very nearly destroyed ourselves with nuclear wars and whatnot. And Kirk basically says, well, we didn't do that. That's a great example of just the specter of arrogance creeping into, you know, human nature as it relates to these kinds of discussions. So I think that actually really works to show just what is at every turn, that's the direction that humankind could go.
Yeah, because I really think that this was intended to be an effective juxtaposition, but I don't know, to some degree it just doesn't work, because I see one species who did it and I see another species whose arrogance may eventually lead them to do it. That's what I see. I expected a little bit more humility, understanding, but you just didn't really get that. Because after all, I mean, the point was made and has been made oftentimes in Star Trek, that in the Star Trek universe, you know, Earth survived three world wars, you know, where we nearly obliterated, you know, entire generations of people, but we grew past that. And so I think we do a good job in the Star Trek universe of making the point that we can get past this. We can grow up out of our infancy and attain something better. But Kirk's arrogance here just almost seems digressive towards that argument.
I mean, well, in general, this is one of the problems with the episode. Kirk's responses to a great many things in this episode don't really make sense. He overreacts in his impassioned speech about, you know, risk being part of our business and whatnot. And I think, you know, again, his reaction to Sargon doesn't necessarily make sense. So I think, you know, maybe the writing for Kirk is not at its best in this episode. But as you're talking, I'm trying to think of other uses of this disembodied consciousness. You know, what role does this serve, and what points could Gene Roddenberry be trying to make? And one thing that occurred to me is that, you know, the situation culturally has changed from the 60s to now. You know, we live in an age now when the geeks have kind of won the culture war, right? It's cool to know a lot of things. It's cool to work in technology. You know, it's cool to be a Star Trek fan. more or less, right? And, you know, that was not true, you know, back in the 1960s. If you were a smart, mathematically inclined, you know, geek in the 60s, you were kind of an egghead, right? So when I see these balls of light, I see them as sort of the 1960s version of an egghead. They're so in their own heads that they've lost touch with, you know, the world around them. And they've just, you know, become so inwardly drawn that they've forgotten how to fix their own machines, and they've forgotten how to interact socially, and they've just become disembodied heads. They're eggheads. And that's what I think of in this episode. And I sort of think of Gene Roddenberry as making a point here. As knowledge progresses, and as our technology improves, we're in danger of being disembodied and losing touch with this essential part of ourselves, which is the embodied part of ourselves that grounds us in the physical reality. And I think we all know people like this who are so in their heads that they've lost touch with the nature of who they are. They forget to eat, or they forget how to, they don't sleep, they stay up too late. They're so obsessed with something or the other, they're literally just in their own heads. And I can see Gene Roddenberry making some sort of commentary about either about individual psychology, about being too much in your own head, or even socially, or some sort of social commentary in technology about the danger of being so intelligent that you lose touch with the kind of the physical world that grounds the kind of being that we are. You know, we are fundamentally embodied beings. And so the contrast between these dualist aliens that are just disembodied consciousnesses but fail in a great many ways, and the more embodied human presence in this episode, that's a stark contrast. I mean, I wonder if Gene Roddenberry is just making some sort of commentary about being in your own head and the danger of progressiveness from a technological standpoint or from a psychological standpoint in providing that contrast in this episode.
I will never be able to watch this episode again and look at those receptacles in the same way, because now every time I look at one of them, I'm going to imagine Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin's Conehead characters from Saturday Night Live circa 1970s.
Not Coneheads, eggheads.
But their heads remind me of eggs. Sargon's voice is going, it's going to be more like this.
Yeah, none of that booming authoritative voice. No, it's, no. You know, I mean, am I way off base on this one? I don't know if I'm reaching in drawing this connection, but it's part of the contrast that he's drawing. You know, these are these fundamentally mental beings. Mm-hmm. They've lost their bodies. They've lost their ability to function in any sort of normal social environment. Compared with, you know, the robustness of an embodied human life, with bodies that feel pleasure and bodies that suffer in various ways and bodies that have relationships in various ways, versus being just a disembodied consciousness that's stuck in your own head. I think that's rich on many levels.
Yeah, absolutely. All kidding aside, Zachary, and I seem to be in the mood today to kid around, but in all truth, I think you're hitting the nail on the head here. And I do think that this is a commentary. I do think that there's something to say about humanity and where it can go and what direction perhaps it might even be going. Because you're right, these aliens have lost their, and I use this term loosely, their humanity. They are trapped inside these receptacles. They don't feel physical pleasure. In fact, that's one of the more moving, I think, scenes in the episode, is when Sargon and Thalacia actually see and touch for the first time. And it's interesting to me because, you know, obviously Molhal doesn't look like Thalacia, and Kirk, I'm sure, doesn't look anything like Sargon, but it's the idea that eyes are looking at each other for the first time. They say the eyes are the windows to the soul. I don't think their physical appearances matter so much as it is the idea that he is looking at her and she is looking at him, and they have the ability to touch. And I think those scenes are drawn out for a reason. I think it is Gene Roddenberry and his writing team saying to humanity that we can't afford to continue to go down a road of self-destruction, because this is the end. Not necessarily that, you know, we're going to end up in receptacles, Zachary, but that we're going to lose our humanity to the violence and the mistrust, and we're going to lose something in our humanity. We're going to cease to have the ability to see each other as human beings, to touch, to feel. We're going to lose something here. And I think, in truth, here we are in 2016, and I think to some degree he's exactly right, because we do live in a time where we have become very desensitized to suffering, and we see it, and it's easy for us to turn a blind eye to it, to look the other way. We've gotten to the point to where it's just all over television, it's all over the news, it's everywhere. It's on the front page of the newspaper, it's on our news feeds when we pull up Facebook or the internet, and we've become very desensitized to it, and we've gotten to the point where I think we have lost a piece of our humanity, to the point that, no, we're, again, not in receptacles, but we've lost something of what it really means to be human.
This may be a case of the episode just trying to take on too much at the same time. I mean, on the one hand, it's a terribly romantic kind of episode, right? Mm-hmm. There's this sensualism to the episode that is omnipresent in this episode. You've got the relationship between Sargon and Thalesa. You've got Henok's, you know, desire for Thalesa, and it's very sensual all the way around. And I think it's unquestionable that is portrayed not necessarily from Henok, but that's portrayed as a virtue, the ability to feel and the ability to empathize and the ability to have a relationship in that way is portrayed as a virtue. So yes, I think you're right. You know, Gene Roddenberry is commenting that there's a danger of losing some important aspects of our humanity, whether it's the ability to empathize, whether it's the ability to feel and whatnot. But I'm trying to think of different ways that this disembodied consciousness is used to make a point. And so I think it's clear that there's this kind of anti-technology, you know, being in your head, egghead version. There's the anti-sensualism, you know, interpretation of this, that these beings have lost touch with their physical selves and all the things that go along with that, whether it's pleasure, whether it's empathy. But I also sort of think there's this point of, like, maybe over relying on technology. Like, I'm thinking of, I mean, we live in the 21st century. Everyone has things like an iPhone. Everyone has various pieces of electronic equipment. You know, we've achieved so much technologically, just like the aliens in this episode. You know, they had a progressive society, and they were on this, you know, progressive, technologically advanced path. Mm-hmm. And then they became disembodied at a certain point. Think how many people you know around you, you know, make, you know, they enjoy the fruits of all of this innovation, but they have no interest in understanding how it works. They have no ability to fix it when it breaks. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the understanding about the world around us has diminished even as we've become more technologically advanced. And I think that's an interesting paradox here. You know, to the point where you basically become a talking head. You can't fix your own machines anymore. What if the machines break around you? What if you can't sustain your society anymore? I can kind of see these aliens being some sort of a metaphor for a breakdown of society, even despite the progressiveness that, you know, as we become overly reliant on technology, we lose our ability to function autonomously, and, you know, and society collapses. And I think something like that might have happened to the aliens in this episode. While their society has progressed, they became so reliant on it that they didn't need to function at that lower, more basic, more physical level. At some point, they became disembodied. We don't know how that works, of course, right? But it's a metaphor. It's a story. Mm-hmm. But I could see that being a grand metaphor for the breakdown of their society as a whole, even as they became a progressive society.
Well, Sargon says to Captain Kirk, he said, "One day our minds became so powerful we dared think ourselves as gods." So I think what he's really describing there is kind of that moment, if you will, that they sort of lost touch with who they were, and their in their arrogance, I think long before their physical bodies became disembodied from their consciousness, I think long before that, you know, they had really lost touch with who they are. I like the sensual aspect of this because that sense of physical touch is so ingrained in humanity. We know, Zachary, from much research that physical touch is as actually healing, that you can help promote the healing process just through physical touch. We know, I think all of us know that, you know, the pleasure aspects of it, but it goes much, much deeper than that. There's a deep physical need for touch, for affection, for we show our children affection, we show our significant other affection. This is something that's very ingrained in who we are. And I think that those couple of scenes there where Sargon and Thalesa are experiencing that, I think are slowed down. They're taken slowly because I think they're trying to make the point that this is something that's so basic to our own humanity that we would do almost anything to get it back. I have to say, though, on kind of a silly note, those scenes were just a little creepy for me because I was always taught as a child that when two lovers are showing affection, you don't stare. You kind of look away. And it surprises me, and I'm thinking about Nurse Chapel. I can still see Nurse Chapel standing there. I mean, she is eyes on. She's like watching 50 Shades of Technicolor here. I mean...
Well, Mike, that's because you're from West Virginia. Out here in California, we were actually taught to stare. Just FYI. So.
I think it's the same here in Texas, though. I think you're. I don't know. It's a little different. Maybe that's California.
But I think you make a really interesting point, and I think the role of sensualism inside this episode is easy to overlook because we're talking about a great many other things besides sensualism, mm-hmm. consciousness and future evolution and whatnot. But I think the sensualism here is really important because there's a contrast between the way Sargon approaches sensualism with Thalesa and the way that Henoch approaches sensualism with Thalesa. Right. And I think I don't want to like psychoanalyze Gene Roddenberry because I don't think that's my place and I don't think I'm very good at it. I don't think I know enough about him. And it's not really the purpose of Metatrex, but I wonder a little bit of whether this is a little bit of Gene Roddenberry wrestling with his own demons. I think for any virtue, you know, whether it's sensual pleasure, whether it's moral responsibility, whatever it is, there's a good side and a bad side. There's a way it's used well and there's a way it's used badly. And I could see this kind of dual nature of some of these virtues in this episode. Like there's a fine line between attraction and
obsession.
Yeah, attraction and lust or pleasure mm-hmm. and obsession, right? There's a very fine line between these concepts sometimes. And, you know, I just see that this episode seems to be commenting in some way on two different standpoints as it relates to being an embodied being and all the things that go along with it. So I don't know if I'm reaching here a little bit, but I can definitely see a contrast between two different approaches to that sensuality in the episode.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think there was another interesting conversation between Thalesa and McCoy where she is trying to convince him to allow her to keep Dr. Malhall's body. And Dr. McCoy says to her, "I'm not going to peddle flesh. I'm a physician." And, you know, Thalesa says something, you know, very smart back, and, you know, you know, to in contrast to who I am, you're nothing but a prancing savage medicine man. And
well, one of the scenes that ended up on the cutting room floor, Mike, is Mulhall telling Thalesa, "I'm sorry, I've got to save myself for Riker's dad." That one didn't make the episode.
Yeah, that they I do remember that being in the being in the bonus features.
That might actually come out in the Roddenberry vault. Keep your eye out for that one.
But again, I think it's very interesting here because she's willing to do almost anything to hang on to her physical body because she doesn't want to live inside an android that is anatomically male. She doesn't want to live forever as a machine. She just wants to regain her physical life and live it out. And for that matter, Henoch is kind of in the same, he's kind of in that same park. He's willing to commit murder to hang on to Spock's body. And he almost succeeds.
Well, insofar as this episode is commentary on religion, I think that's present in this episode. Clearly, there's mention of a disembodied oblivion afterlife kind of existence, state of existence at the end of the episode. I don't think that's the major part of the episode like we've talked about. But insofar as that is a part of the episode, I think that this episode raises an interesting question. If you are willing to entertain the notion of an afterlife, what should our attitude in response to that be? Is a disembodied, eternal, existence, along the lines of a heaven or whatnot, is that something even desirable? Would we want to live an eternity in a disembodied state? Is that something to strive for, as a lot of religions think it is, or is that sort of the antithesis of what real human life is? For some people, I think that sounds like a version of hell, like an eternal existence with no body. That sounds terrible. It's like an eternal mental prison or something. I'm thinking of the play No Exit by Jean-Paul Sartre. This sort of disembodied state for an eternity, no less, is kind of like being in your own mental prison, like a room you can't get out of. And I think a lot of us think of our consciousness in this way. I mean, when you really focus on it, you are stuck inside your own head with your own consciousness, and that's it. You've got nothing else, right? You've got the world outside of you that you experience. But there's a sense in which you can really grow weary of that imprisonment of your own mental state. And I wonder if this episode is commenting on that in some way, this disembodied mental existence being a kind of hell. It's not something to strive for. It's something to be anxious and worry about and be skeptical of. It's not something to idealize or something even to strive for. So I just wonder if there's a connection between the religious theme and this disembodiedness as it relates to, whether the afterlife or any sort of disembodied ideal heaven-like state is even something to strive for, whether it's something we should shun and avoid. You know, I guess that's the question that this episode kind of asks the viewer: is this form of life that we see in these disembodied aliens, is that something to strive for? Is that a model to emulate, to live forever and, shed all these, biological weaknesses we have? Or is that itself a kind of prism?
Yeah, I'd be interested to get some feedback from someone like Dr. Hawking, who physically is very limited, but mentally is nearly limitless. I'd be interested to get the opinion of someone like that who has experienced serious physical limitations and yet has been able to thrive as an intellectual. I've mentioned this before on Metatreks, and who am I to disagree with Dr. Hawking? But there are many things that he and I disagree on, but I admire him infinitely, because he has transcended something that for most human beings would have just been the end of them. And he's transcended that and indeed has thrived in spite of it. And so he's an incredible inspiration to me. And so I'd be interested to get his take on that. But I think that the thing that interests me the most about this, and you all on the Ready Room talked about this a little bit, and in fact, Zachary, as I recall, you gave a pretty good commentary on the position of many of the denominations of Christianity, none of which really are in total agreement on this idea of the afterlife. It is a very complex a very complex theological question that there are many, many ideas and opinions and theories about. In fact, we can go to Scripture, and Scripture is very clear in some respects, and very cryptic in others. And so there's been much debate even among Christians about the nature of the afterlife. For instance, you know, when we die, do we immediately go to heaven or do we go to a place of rest? Between Protestant Christians and Catholic Christians, are there two places, a heaven and a hell, or are there in fact three possible outcomes, heaven, hell, and purgatory? In fact, there are debates regarding what happens later on in the afterlife, after death. Is there a physical resurrection of the body, or is there just a disembodied existence as a spirit or a wisp or a soul, whatever you want to call it? So there's much debate even among Christians. And that's not even factoring in the ideas of other belief systems. You know, just looking at major religions, there's no agreement here. So I think it would be futile for you and I to sit and get into a long conversation about oblivion in the afterlife. But I think for most people, the idea of going off into nothingness is not a very appealing thing. And I think that's evidenced by the fact that nearly every major religion has some type of physical afterlife, a physical place of existence, whether it would be a sense of reincarnation or whether it would be a place like heaven or whatnot. I've done an extensive amount of research on near-death experiences, and I have cataloged both positive and negative near-death experiences. I find them very fascinating, and to some degree, I think they're probably one of the few windows that we have into the idea of what occurs when we die. I know what the Bible teaches, and as a theologian and as a Christian, I accept the teachings of the Bible. But you know, there's a fascination for me about what occurs. I've got personal stories of people close to me who have died, and for which I have been present during that time. And my stories I've added to my catalog of experiences that I think in many ways reinforce my own belief system. But I think this is a very complex issue, a very complex subject that I don't think you and I could do any justice to. But I think as evidenced by the fact that most religions have some type of afterlife, I think for most human beings, the idea of oblivion is not appealing.
See, I think maybe your intuitions and my intuitions differ a little bit in terms of the role that the afterlife plays for religion in general, and maybe for Christianity in particular, and what the average, you know, run-of-the-mill believers' responses to that role. I think in general, even though there is a lot of disagreement amongst various denominations, like you described, what they all generally have in common is that is some sort of an ideal, right? It's something to strive for. You know, they all think that, you know, the afterlife in some sort of a Christian sense, in whatever state it is the end goal for them from an eternal standpoint, mm-hmm. right? That's what they're striving for. And as I sit down and I ask myself, why is that? Why is some sort of, whether it's disembodied, whether it's embodied, why is this eternal afterlife in whatever form something to strive for? The answer that I keep coming back to is that the world that we live in right now, you know, the physical world that is finite and temporal with all of its struggles, is largely a world of pain. You know, you have to work your way through existence. Mm-hmm. You have to earn your keep. You suffer. You have illnesses. People around you die, whether from old age, whether in car accidents, whatnot. It's a lot of pretty terrible things in this world. It's not an easy world to get through. So I sort of see this afterlife from a kind of purely from a psychological standpoint, which is no commentary on whether it's true or false, right? The psychological drive is some sort of escapism. I want to free myself of the burdens of this world and find some sort of peace in some sort of afterlife. Mm-hmm. And that's something, some sort of an ideal. What I see going on in this episode of Star Trek, though, is kind of a reverse perspective on that this eternal disembodied state, which has no suffering. I think the aliens in this episode of the original series are not suffering in any way. They've achieved what a great many religious believers are striving towards, right? I think the perspective of this episode is pretty clear that that's not an ideal to strive for. It comes with a lot of loss of the essential characteristics of human existence in having a disembodied, for what is all intents and purposes, an afterlife. So, you know, what's an afterlife if not a 600,000 year long disembodied existence, right? I just don't see this episode as saying that's something to desire. I see it saying the exact opposite. That's something to avoid. This episode doesn't have anything positive to say about that state of existence, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think in some respects, it almost seems as though these aliens have achieved some type of nirvana, some existence on another plane. And it almost seems like they're giving that up when they finally resign to the idea of you know, going off into oblivion. I did appreciate the conversation that Sargon and Thalesa have at the end of the episode, where she's taking her comfort in the fact that at least they're going to be there together. And I think that's something that's very human, because we all have that great desire. My wife's aunt passed away, matter of fact, just last night, and one of her great comforts was to know that her husband was going to be there. And she took comfort in the fact that my wife's mother, who passed away a few years ago, is going to be there. And so she drew comfort from that. And I see that kind of modeled here in this episode, where Thalesa is drawing comfort from the idea that, you know, well, okay, we're going to go off into oblivion, but, you know, at least we won't be alone. Say, husband, that you'll be there with me. Yeah, I'll be there. Whatever, honey, I'll be there.
This is part of what just doesn't make sense in this episode to me, because on the one hand, these are disembodied aliens, and that connotes some sort of mind-body dualism. On the other hand, they sure seem to be tied to those damn receptacles, right? So if they're really disembodied, why do they have to be stuck in a receptacle, and why do they need a host body, you know, if they're really genuinely disembodied like they claim to be? And then if they do go off into oblivion, if they're really disembodied, why do they cease to exist? Why is it oblivion? Why is it... And what does that even mean anyway? Right? And we talked about this during the episode of the Ready Room, when we talked about Return to Tomorrow, that this notion of oblivion is really vaguely defined and it's not spelled out at all. But I just think this episode kind of fails to commit. Are these aliens disembodied beings or not? If they're disembodied, why do they need receptacles? Why do they need host bodies? And why is it oblivion if they depart the host body? If they're not disembodied, then they're not disembodied, and none of the rest of the episode makes any sense. So I just don't see these aliens as being very well defined in terms of what they are. And again, that drives some of the weirdness in the plot of the episode.
Yeah, I didn't want to get into this too much because you guys did such a great job talking about it on the Ready Room. But I agree with you. There's some things here that don't work. They're tied to those receptacles. Why? Is there disembodied nature? Is it something technological, or is it something that they achieved on some type of metaphysical, physical, you know, physiological plane?
The Organians or something.
Yeah,
right?
I don't know.
Sure.
And we don't know that. We don't know if it was something technological or physiological. We don't know what the answer to that is. We do know that for a time, they were able to live inside the ship's systems, which I thought that was interesting. Why do they got to go off into oblivion? If they can just store them on one of those little yellow discs, then they can kind of do what they did with Moriarty.
This is the pineal gland problem all over again, right?
Yes.
If you have disembodied aliens that have to interact with the physical world in some way, how exactly does that work? This is exactly the problem that Descartes was trying to address in his mind-body dualism, right? Descartes said, well, okay, if my consciousness is this disembodied, non-physical substance, but it sure seems like it's tied to my body in some way, well, how the hell does that work? And he gave this really, you know, what we think of as a ridiculous answer. The pineal gland is the place where the soul and the body, or the mind and the body, connect with each other, and they're tied together in some way. That's like saying, okay, these aliens, how can they interact with the physical world if they're genuinely disembodied? Well, they're tied to these receptacles. Well, they're tied to the host body. Well, they're tied to the ship's computer, right? It's the pineal gland problem all over again. And just as the pineal gland is a totally unsatisfactory answer to the problem of mind-body dualism and how mind and body are connected, I think any one of those things, the receptacle or the ship's computer or the host body, all of those are totally unsatisfactory answers in terms of how these disembodied aliens can be tied to the physical world in some way.
Yeah, and again, another problem with this is the idea that, for instance, with Spock, you know, Kirk said Spock's consciousness is gone. We have to kill the body, the thing that's in it. And what they ended up doing at the end of the episode is they actually trick him by injecting him with nothing more than a tranquilizer that would knock him out, and basically try to trick Hancock into leaving Spock's body and going off into oblivion, which I'll say again, connotes something negative. Oblivion is the idea of nothingness. It's non-existence. It's not the afterlife. It connotes the idea of non-existence. So for a species that's able to live inside ship systems, and he gave up awful easily. I mean, they give Spock a tranquilizer and then he just runs off into oblivion.
I got to say, Mike, we should both be really impressed with our impassioned criticism of this episode. And by the way, did you know that risk is our business?
Risk is our business, Zachary.
Yeah.
I want to say something about the speech. I don't think we can do an episode on Return to Tomorrow, which, as you guys pointed out, has nothing to do. The title has nothing to do with this episode. But I can't have a conversation about this without talking about the speech. The speech was great. It didn't fit the episode, but the speech was great. I love when Kirk said, they used to say, if man could fly, he'd have wings. But he did fly. He discovered he had to. Do you wish that the first Apollo mission hadn't reached the moon? I love this because it's prophetic in many ways. Because in 1968, we hadn't reached the moon yet. Yes, the Apollo project was well on its way, and it was a matter of time. But I love the prophetic nature of this episode. Kirk's talking about going to the moon.
It's a good thing it went well. Otherwise, they would have had some serious egg on their face after the fact, right?
Indeed.
Eggheads with egg on their face.
Eggheads with it, yeah. And then he even goes beyond that and said, and we wouldn't have gone on to Mars or the nearest star. Well, you know, we've sent unmanned probes to Mars, and we've sent Voyager out into the stars. And so I love the prophetic nature of this. Again, this is something I think that Star Trek does so well. But getting right down to the speech, you know, Kirk says Dr. McCoy is right in pointing out the enormous danger potential in any contact with life and intelligence as fantastically advanced as this. But I must point out that the possibilities, the potential for knowledge and achievement is equally great. Risk is our business. That's what this starship's all about. That's why we're aboard her. What a great mission statement, Zachary, for Star Trek. Because risk is the business, and that's what Star Trek's all about. And they took risks. Oftentimes, being the type of show that it was in the late 1960s, and then in the 80s and 90s, and the golden age, as many people call it, of Star Trek, you know, continuing to examine the human condition, to do it in a way that's very progressive and very inclusive, and to really explore ideas that in their time were taboo for television. And sometimes those risks were home runs, and sometimes those risks fell flat. Sometimes the risks that they took fell flat in the time that they took them, but looking back on them, you know, we appreciate them in whole new ways. And I think there are many things, as we've said several times here on the podcast today, and there are many things about this episode that don't work, but there are many things in this episode that do work. But I think it's up to us to kind of go back and to mine them out and appreciate them for what they were then, but also appreciate what it's saying to us now.
I think one of the things I like about the way in which Star Trek deals with issues like this, the issue of taking risks, for example, I think that there's two ways you can read Star Trek's point. One is sort of a sociological direction, that in order for mankind as a whole to move forward, we need to take risks, right? If we don't go to the moon, we don't go to Mars, we don't go to outer space, we don't get Star Trek, right? We have to take risks in order to move ourselves into the future. The other reading of these kinds of issues, I think, is an individual psychological reading. And I find this interesting because we all, you know, live individual lives that have to, we have to get up and have some purpose and figure out what directions we want our lives to go. And, you know, this question of taking risks, it can be done at a societal level. What risks should we as a society take to move forward? But then there's individual risk. What risks do you take in your own life to move your own life forward and get to a point where you want it to be? Whether it's happiness, whether it's achieving a goal, you're not going to do any of those things unless you take certain kinds of risks. And I think it's the same lesson, really, right? You need to take risks if you want to achieve something. But I think you can it's interesting to me that you can read it in two levels. You can read it as making some sort of a sociological point about society as a whole, or you can read it individually. Like, you know, if I want to, you know, create something, if I want to, you know, have a certain standard of living, if I want to achieve some sort of personal happiness, all of that involves various type of risks. And it's sad because I think you can see, you can imagine a society that stagnates, that doesn't take the risk, that never moves into the future in the way that we see in Star Trek. And I like the progressiveness of Star Trek. I like envisioning a better way that human life could be out there in the galaxy somewhere. I think it's a fascinating mental exercise, and it sets the ideals that we might want to strive towards. It's also sad to see an individual that doesn't take risks. I think I know people like this. You probably know people like this, people that don't, they have lofty goals, but they never take the risks to achieve them. So they never achieve them. And they're stagnant. They're not going to start that business. They're not going to create the thing they want to create. They're not going to paint that painting. They're not going to, you know, be happy in the way that they want to be happy because they're unwilling to take the risks. And I think this episode is just a great commentary in both of those levels. You know, Star Trek does give you a vision of the future, but it also gives you, some sort of personal values, right? This willingness to get out there and take that personal risk. It might mean embarrassment. It might mean failure. It might mean your own life. But unless you as the individual take those risks, you're not going to achieve the thing you want to achieve unless it's by, you know, some sort of fortuitous accident. Same thing for society. Unless society takes a certain kind of risks, we're not going to achieve the great things that we could achieve in society. It's also very easy to forget from our 21st century perspective the progressiveness of the 1960s. You know, the 1960s were the era of Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society, right? The idea that we could put our heads together, create things as a group, and sort of force society into the future, and that involves taking certain kind of risks. And, you know, if we don't do those things, society will be stagnant. We'll be living in the past or we'll be living in the present, but we won't be throwing ourselves into the future. And I just think this is a great, you know, commentary on both of those levels. You know, there's the individual risk taking, and then there's the risk that society as a whole has to take in order to achieve something great and create not just an adequate society, but a truly great society. And that idea of a great society comes straight out of the 1960s.
I think in the end, Zachary, I think this was a bad risk to take.
What, doing a Metatrex episode on this episode of Star Trek? This was a risky episode of Metatrex, everyone. We're risking embarrassment, failure, being laughed off the network.
I think for Captain Kirk and crew, this was a bad risk to take. It was an unnecessary risk. And frankly, I don't want to go where you guys went on the Ready Room 201 because you guys, I think, had a very good, intelligent, fun conversation about this. So I don't really want to tread there, but I don't think this was very uncharacteristic of Captain Kirk. This was very uncharacteristic of the rest of the crew. And you guys made that point, I think, very, very well on the Ready Room 201. So I think this was a bad risk for them to take, but I think this was a great risk. One that I think didn't work very well, but I think for Gene Roddenberry and for Star Trek, this was a great risk to take because it gave us an interesting exploration of the idea that we can control our future. You know, we can determine now what humanity evolves into in the future. And I think really at the heart of this episode, that's really what it's about. It's about where are we going as a human creature? What are we going to evolve into? I think that's at the base of what this episode's all about. I kind of grab onto, you know, this kind of physical, metaphysical thing with the disembodied consciousness and the nature of consciousness. And I grab onto the idea of oblivion and the afterlife. But I think at the end of the day, this episode was really all about our own existentialism and, you know, what we're going to eventually allow ourselves to evolve into.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think for my final thoughts, I think that unlike most species on the planet, their evolutionary path is not under their own control. They're subject to the forces around them. Humans seem to be of a different nature in this regard. We have at least got to the point where we can control our own evolution to some degree, right? We can decide the using our minds collectively, we can decide what path do we as a species take. And I think Gene Roddenberry is clued into this, that this is our future evolution is something that is now under our own control, which means it's up to us today to decide what future humans will be like. The choices we make now will dictate what path our entire species gets set on. And so it's on our shoulders. You know, do we become these disembodied aliens with all the problems that they have, or do we become the better version of humanity? It's up to us to, you know, look, throw ourselves into the future and look to see what path it takes. Take whatever risks are necessary to get out there and make the best vision of ourselves happen. And if we don't, we're either going to devolve or we're going to evolve into something that we don't want to be. And so the worst thing we could do is leave our own future state to chance. You know, that's what animals do, right? Human beings have the ability to look inward, look at the world around them, put our brains together and make a decision about what path we want to follow. And if we don't make good choices now, you know, we're condemning future humans to, a disembodied life in a receptacle, maybe. So for my final thoughts, I think that's the most interesting part of the episode is this idea of transhumanism. What will future versions of humans be like when we move beyond whatever form we're in now? And I think more importantly, it's under our control. The choices we make now will dictate what that future will be.
So basically what you're saying is we have a choice to live out a future and become the best versions of ourselves, or to live our existence, a sucky existence, in a receptacle living vicariously through whoever might pass by.
In a light ball, yes.
In a light ball.
Maybe that's a bit of a false dichotomy. There are probably more options than that. But that is definitely the false dichotomy that Gene Roddenberry is giving us in this episode of Star Trek.
Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about Return to Tomorrow, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek-FM this past week. So here's a quick look, everybody, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
It's not a primitive culture, right? The Bajorans are not a primitive culture. They're actually a very mature culture that has moved beyond our technological phase and found a way to have balance in their lives again.
Literary Treks.
The big difference is when you're doing nonfiction books, we do a lot of interviewing. And the interviewing requires a lot of transcribing tapes, and that's possibly the most miserable job one could ever run into. It's a real task.
The 602 Club.
It is time for us to explore Superman and the questions about him in a new and different way in the context of the world in which we live, and that's what Snyder is doing. People just don't like it because, you know what? Superman hasn't changed, but the world in which Superman's trying to serve has.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support that you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions on the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we've discussed in this episode of Metatreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can always contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
To leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page on the Trek FM website, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, our Twitter handle is @trekfm.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm, and find us in the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type Babel into the search field on Facebook. That's B-A-B-E-L, and it'll come right up. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and a review of Metatreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. In fact, Zachary, we received a new rating and review on the American iTunes Store. JSM Fine Art gave us a 5-star rating and says, "Just stumbled upon this podcast recently, and now I'm burning through them like Khan chasing Kirk around perdition's flames. Great insight into the concepts at work behind the many incarnations of Star Trek. I especially appreciate the references to Enterprise." That's one of my favorite episodes or series as well. A very often overlooked series that explores some of the most interesting questions raised in the franchise. The hosts have good on-air chemistry and do a great job breaking down chunky philosophical concepts into digestible bites and applying them with insightful wit. By the way, he says, Zachary, and this is for you because you turned me onto this as well, thank you for the heads up on Chief O'Brien at work. Hilarious. Well, thank you so much, JSM Fine Art, for that wonderful rating and review. We appreciate your input to us on the show and hope you'll continue to listen.
Yeah, I've got to say, it's reviews like that that give us the strength to continue doing new episodes of Metatreks each and every week. We love bringing you content, but it's a lot of work. You know, Mike, I don't know how many hours you and I collectively put into each episode of Metatreks. It's probably creeping up on 15 or so hours every single week to do an episode of Metatreks collectively.
Yes.
On top of our jobs, on top of our regular lives. And it's hard. It's very easy to go, man, this is a lot of work, and I hope this is worth it for the people who are listening. And it's reviews like that that really do give us the confidence that we're adding something to the discussion, that people are enjoying what we're trying to do in combining Star Trek and philosophy. People are learning things. People are having discussions they wouldn't have otherwise. And I hope that we play some part in that. So thank you very much. That reviews like that give us the strength to get up, you know, next week and do another episode of Metatreks, find a new topic, find a new angle to discuss. And we're going to keep doing that for a long time to come. So thank you very much for that nice review.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Well, Zachary, when you are not living vicariously in a light ball, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me, you can join me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, and you can always find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, @ZacharyFruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you are not contemplating your own future evolution, where can people find you on the Trek FM network and around the interwebs these days?
Well, Zachary, on Facebook, that's where I'm most active. I frequently visit the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. Well, Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank our founder and publisher here at Trek FM, C. Brian Jones. We'd also like to thank our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and our newest executive producer, Ken Tripp. I'd also like to acknowledge our art director, Aaron Harvey, and our production manager, Richard Marquez. Zachary, we'd also like to give a big shout out to our associate producers here at Metatrex, Patrick Devlin. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @MagicDrop5. And also Kay Elizabeth Janeway. You can connect with her as well on Twitter @ChocoWeeble. We want to thank you both so much for your support of Metatrex and for Trek FM as a whole. And thank you, everyone, for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.